Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
For the first 10 months of this fiscal year, ag exports are running about 8% below last year, but USDA economist Bart Kenner says it's bulk products like corn that are taking the biggest hit this year, bulk products racking up export sales of just over $56 billion.
Down 14% from this time last year.
Kenner told us most bulk commodities have seen a sales decline.
Exports of wheat were $5.4 billion, down 10% from this time last year. Corn exports were $11.7 billion, down 33%. And cotton exports were $5.6 billion, down 27%.
One notable exception, soybeans, they're hanging in there ahead of last year at this time, not by a lot, just 2%, with sales at a little over $30 billion. Gary Crawford, Washington.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Look, America has to be engaged around the world. I mean, we've got so much goodwill around the world that we don't recognize. People speak English. They love American music. They love American culture. We've got soft power that no other country can match.
Former National Security Advisor in the Trump administration, Robert O'Brien, speaking recently on China and the global supply chain at the Hudson Institute.
And combined with our allies, with the British and the French, influence we have around the world is tremendous.
And someone who understands trade, former senator from Ohio and former director of the OMB, and the 14th U.S. Trade Representative, Rob Portman.
Again, I think we, over the years, over the last couple of decades in particular, we've kind of ignored the threat from China, including the theft of our intellectual property, which helped to grow the economy, but also the rise of their military. We kind of ignored some of the human rights concerns with the Uyghurs and others. We kind of ignored some of the trade imbalances because China, as you know, is not a market economy, and they have more and more state-owned enterprises. Actually, now they're, for a while, they pushed economic reforms. There were fewer, now there are more, and they subsidize heavily and sometimes sell below their costs, which is dumping. And that's not fair to American workers or to workers around the world. So, you know, we have to deal with these issues, and that doesn't even get into the issue of Taiwan and what's going on there, what's happened in Hong Kong, or other issues like the military aggression we see in the South China Sea that worries so many of their regional neighbors. So I think there has to be a balance here where, given our engagement with China, which is significant, again, the water bottle example, and so many other products, that we continue to have a healthy trade relationship, put it on a more level playing field so that they're not subsidizing unfairly or otherwise not following the rules of international trade. But then with regard to these products or services that are of a strategic interest to us, I think we have to go in with our eyes open, and we have to come up with a way to determine what is strategic and what is not. That's not easy. So you might think a toy or a water bottle, that's easy. Dual-use military commercial technology that would help their military, that's easy. That should be in the category of us de-risking from that. But how about robotics? Or how about farm machinery? Where does that land? So these are all challenges. We talked a lot about this last couple of days. And frankly, you know, some of the smartest economists in the country are there, not including me, but including these two. And we didn't have any answers. So when you get down to it, you know, in my view, we need to have a engagement with China. We need to have a dialogue with China. They are the second largest economy in the world, likely to become the largest economy in the world in the next couple of decades. And we need to have a healthy relationship, but we also need, again, to do so without naivete. We need to know, you know, that what we're doing is actually helping to deal with some of the issues that we talked about earlier. So I'm hopeful that with the increased dialogue we've seen just in the last couple of months, that we can get back on a more normal track here, but at the same time, again, have a conscious strategic de-risking. And again, the private sector is doing a lot of that on its own, but some of it government will have to play a role in terms of some of these truly strategic goods and technologies.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The thing that's also impossible to talk about, in many ways, it's our demographics.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
Yeah, it's a big word, but it's everything, because it's the cascade of your ability to grow the economy. It's the ability to have innovation. It is the driver of almost 100% of the future debt, actually 100% of the future debt being healthcare costs, the collapse of the Social Security Trust Fund, those sorts of things. We in the industrialized West and the United States included have gotten much older. And yet it's almost the thing we're terrified to talk about.
He was featured in a recent interview with Forbes and says, all you need to do is look at the math.
If someone actually just reads, and look, it's one of the reasons I respect what you do so much, is you're one of the few outlets that's doing sort of adult conversation, adult interviews. Much of our information we either get through our phones or we see on cable news is whatever the outrageous shiny object is of the today. What can we be enraged at today? Yet every single second, we borrow, what, $51,000 every second. And by the end of the decade, we're close to $90,000 a second. It's that is the greatest threat to this republic. But it's also impossible to talk about, because the vast majority of that growth and that borrowing, that spending, is healthcare costs.
And he also admits there's a growing disconnect between political parties and voters.
I think actually, if you really dive into the postmortem, which we have, you see a substantial movement of people moving their voter registration to independent. So they're annoyed with Democrats. They're annoyed with Republicans. They've actually become, you see the growth of independent registration. We're actually even looking at our congressional district, and probably by the end of the decade, being registered independent may be my number one registration, not Republican. And so where I think there's a failure in your question is, was it a blue wave or was it a failure of particularly Republican candidates to actually focus on what voters cared about? And this often happens to us. We have things we care about passionately. We talk about those instead of taking a step backwards. My congressional district may be the highest inflation in the continental United States. As a matter of fact, it is the highest inflation in the continental United States. Maybe talking about and fixating on how you're going to help on the gas and groceries and just the ability to afford life, you know, and your family and those things. So what happens when parties often become so focused on the issues they care about instead of the issues their voters care about? And in many ways, Democrats did a better job of talking about that, those stories, than many of the Republicans did. But it's interesting. It's more complex, because the voters are a lot smarter than the political class often gives them credit for. You can actually see sort of the splits. So the legislature stayed Republican, and some of the top offices were taken by the Democrats.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think we have to frame out the performance of the stock market in a couple ways.
Answering the question of whether it's a recovery or a bubble. Adina Friedman, CEO of the NASDAQ.
First, we always have to remember that the market is a predictor of the future. So what investors try to do is predict the future of the economy, the future of a sector, a company. And so that all manifests itself in the markets. The second thing you have to look at is history. You know, so what's happened over economic cycles in the past? And I have data that kind of looks at the S&P 500, and then we'll talk about the NASDAQ 100 because it's got a little bit of a different dynamic. But there are, Goldman's actually put together this really interesting report that looks at four stages of an economic cycle, and the first starting with despair, right? So the economy's in decline, and everyone's really morose and very, very pessimistic. And what you actually find is that earnings stay relatively flat, But the market, the PE multiples, they compress, and they can compress by about 35%. And then that drives market performance down about 35%. Well, if you look at 2022, I think we could all say, and that usually, by the way, lasts about 14 months. Well, you could argue that 2022 was the year of despair. And then the next part of the cycle, and this is many cycles that they put together, is the period of hope. And in the period of hope, actually, earnings decline, but everyone's expecting the world to get better. And so PE multiples go up about 80% on average. And so the market ends up about 60%, you know, because you've got declining earnings but growing on multiples. And what you actually look at so far this year on a relative basis is last year the markets were down 25% rather than 35% of average. This year the markets are up 35%, that's S&P 500, versus this 80%, right? So you could argue that there's more to run in terms of that period of hope. And then you've got this 3 to 4 year period of growth. And in that period of time, earnings tend to go up around 7.5 to 10%. The market PEs actually decline a little bit. And so the market actually tends to be relatively flat, interestingly. And then you've got the last period, which is the period of optimism, where everyone is just hoping that the period will continue. And it usually lasts about 2 years, where PE multiples go up again and earnings start to come down. You know, they start to, they're still growing, but not as high. And so it's a really interesting way to frame out where we are. So markets were down about 25% last year. Markets are up 35% this year. You know, if we're a normal cycle, you could argue that there's more to go, and then you get into this period of sustained growth if we can avoid a recession. And what's also interesting is last year, earnings were actually up a little bit. This year, earnings are down, but not as much. So and then you layer on the NASDAQ 100. So why is the NASDAQ 100 outperforming the general market? And I think that's when you get to it more of a sector view. And while the S&P 500 has all the great tech companies in it, the NASDAQ 100 has more of a concentration of the tech companies. And that, to me, you know, the market was down 40% last year, I think, and up about 35% last year, up 40% this year so far. I think that has more to do with an optimism about the future of technology. And the fact that I think it also a recognition that technology is driving the economy. And so as we are in this period of hope, you might have more hope on that sector than you might have in other parts of the economy. So that's my explanation. And so if I were to say, what do I think will happen? I do actually think we have a real chance of a soft landing. I do think that technology could have a significant impact on the productivity of the country over the future, which will then drive more growth. And so if we can land the ship well right now, I think we could have a really good run and continued growth in the economy.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
El Niño's El Niño, right? Absolutely not.
Matt Makins is with Makins Weather.
If you thought for a second and you looked at those images, you know that no two El Niños are identical. So why does it matter? Why do we care about the strength? El Niño is not just El Niño. It breaks it down by strength and impact. So here's weak El Niños temperatures, and here are the temperatures for strong El Niños. Do you see a big difference? Obviously you do. For Alaska, it's going to be pretty warm during El Niño events. But look at parts of Canada. You get a weaker event, and your temperatures somewhat lean cooler for central and eastern Canada versus a super strong El Niño, in which case you have much hotter temperatures. The same for the northern U.S., northern states into the Great Lakes. A lot of heat comes with the strongest El Niños. In weaker ones, it's a little bit more hit and miss. As far as the southern states, from California into Texas, yeah, it's still cool in both cases, but the magnitude of that is different. And for the southeast, say you're around Georgia or Florida, your temperature pattern is much different from weak El Niños to very strong ones. What about in terms of precip? Big differences there too. Weak El Niños, very strong ones. In stronger events, you're able to spread a lot more water across the country versus weaker events. Pacific Northwest would favor from a super strong El Niño. With weaker ones, you tend to be a bit drier. Alaska, coastal areas get a lot more water in super strong El Niño events. And throughout Canada, big differences from one pattern to the other, especially for British Columbia, Alberta, and the Canadian Rockies. So knowing that strength does matter, what's the forecast looking like? If you look at all models plotted together and different agencies, different countries obviously have different computer models, they're all assembled here. Bottom line here, this deep kind of maroon color, brick color, That's the average of some of those models. And that takes us up to about 2 degrees Celsius, warmer than average, in that same ENSO region, the 3.4 region. Very similar to the trajectory I showed you just a few minutes ago in that chart. So what do temperatures do in some of these most similar years? Well, they're very warm from Alaska into British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan. So a lot of the Canadian prairies, very warm in these setups. Northern states, Montana and North Dakota, come away as some of the warmest locations. But we have warmth across the Pacific Northwest, Northern Plains, Great Lakes, into New England. That's with similar years. The cold weather kind of sits down across the south, from Mexico into the southern states. That's what kind of happens in general over the most similar years. Here's our precip layout. Very dry BC into Alberta, the Canadian prairies dry. The Great Lakes region into the mid-Atlantic, very, very dry versus the average. And we get the water from coast to coast along the southern half, if you will, of the country. And we can extend that into the prairies of Colorado, the plains there, into far southeastern Wyoming, Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri will catch some of that water too, but primarily it focuses on the southern tier of the states to get some water during most similar years. What about snowfall? If you look at history, this would be kind of the average snowfall for winter. And again, it's assuming a 10-to-1 inch ratio. So in some cases, like the mountains, you're going to get higher totals than that. But what does this mean? It's kind of hard to grasp. Okay, well, maybe that's the most similar snowfall totals we've had, but what does that do on average? So on average, when we bring in an El Nino like what we're expecting, you reduce snowfall in Alaska, much of Canada, the northern states all reduce the snowfall, cutting it in half in some of those cases. The southern states, however, from the Four Corners through New Mexico, Panhandles, out into the southeast, you can increase your frequency and snowfall total.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I think there's a more seriousness
in trying to explain the changing relationship between Democrats and Republicans. Arizona Representative David Swikert, in a recent interview with Forbes.
The debt ceiling agreement, it was ultimately bipartisan. And it was because there was a serious approach to what's going on in the society, in our government. Unlike my brothers and sisters on the left, who just wanted to raise the debt ceiling and avoid the conversation. Much of my criticism before, when there was unified Democrat control, was the insatiable appetite to keep spending, this functionally lying to the American people, saying, well, if we just raise taxes on people over 400,000, we can finance things. And look, 400,000 and up in income is 2% of the population. We're not going to finance even a fraction of the debt, the borrowing, and the coming borrowing on that 2% of the population. It's sort of the political folklore so many people have run their campaigns on. And look, Republicans are sinners too. We often say, well, if we got rid of foreign aid or waste and fraud, every dime of foreign aid would cover about 12 days of borrowing. So yes, my answer is Republicans were completely frozen out in the previous couple of years. That's Democrat unified government. Now that we have divided government, if you're going to accomplish anything to the point where you get a signature on it, it requires you have to work with both sides. And that's one of the difficulties for everyone here, because we all got so used to sort of the posturing of no Republicans ideas were going to pass. All Democrat ideas were going to pass. And now we're forced to actually talk to each other.
Now that Congress is back in session after the recess, what do they need to be focused on?
The Social Security Trust Fund is not magically going to heal itself. The new projections, substantially because of inflation, and you know my feelings that much of inflation was 100% set up by a combination of monetary policy and Democrat spending. But healthcare inflation is two and a half times faster than mean CPI. Meaning we're seeing some new calculations, like Bloomberg Intelligence, last week said by the end of the decade, we're at 130% debt to GDP. If that math is accurate, that means over this 10 years, we will borrow more than all the publicly held debt that exists today. That's coming off the rails. Even Moody's Analytics has us at 121% of debt to GDP, 9 budget years from now. That's everything. That's what takes down republics. And yet we will sit here and do the shiny objects. And so you ask, what should we be doing with Democrats? Democrats own calculators. I don't know if there's batteries in them, but you know, I'm sorry, that was sarcastic. This is the thing that will ultimately crush the poor, crush the economy. And the ones who really get destroyed are people who are trying to, you know, survive, you know, their retirements, you know, have retirement security, and younger populations who are going to pay just stunning amounts of taxes. And yet, how often is this part of your interviews, your conversations?
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I actually would say that I think that we are certainly near peak rates, if not at peak rates. And what they're really looking for is, you know, a continuation of the trend on downward inflation.
Adina Friedman is CEO of the NASDAQ, talks about the Federal Reserve and interest rates.
I mean, I think they'd be thrilled if they could continue to see this kind of job growth while inflation continues to decline. Obviously, wage growth is one of the biggest determinants of that. And so I'm hopeful that we are at a position where we don't have a rebound, because that's the big concern right now, right?
A rebound in
inflation.
Yep. Yep.
So assuming we don't start to see a rebound in inflation, I actually think we, you know, could be at our, at least I think at, but maybe near peak rates.
But if we're talking about economies, we have to consider the Chinese economy. Rob Portman is a former senator from Ohio, former U.S. trade representative on trade with China.
Again, I think we, over the years, over the last couple of decades in particular, we kind of ignored the threat from China, including the theft of our intellectual property, which helped to grow the economy, but also the rise of their military. We kind of ignored some of the human rights concerns with the Uyghurs and others. We kind of ignored some of the trade imbalances because China, as you know, is not a market economy, and they have more and more state-owned enterprises. Actually, now they're, for a while they pushed economic reforms. There were fewer, now there are more, and they subsidize heavily, and sometimes sell below their costs, which is dumping, and that's not fair to American workers or to workers around the world. So, you know, we have to deal with these issues, and that doesn't even get into the issue of Taiwan and what's going on there, what's happened in Hong Kong. Or other issues like the military aggression we see in the South China Sea that worries so many of their regional neighbors. So I think there has to be a balance here where, given our engagement with China, which is significant, again, the water bottle example, and so many other products, that we continue to have a healthy trade relationship, put it on a more level playing field so that they're not subsidizing unfairly or otherwise not following the rules of international trade. But then with regard to these products or services that are of a strategic interest to us, I think we have to go with our eyes open, and we have to come up with a way to determine what is strategic and what is not. That's not easy. So you might think a toy or a water bottle, that's easy. Dual-use military commercial technology that would help their military, that's easy. That should be in the category of us de-risking from that. But how about robotics? Or how about farm machinery? Where does that land? So these are all challenges. We talked a lot about this last couple of days. And frankly, you know, some of the smartest economists in the country are there, not including me, but including these two. And we didn't have any answers. So when you get down to it, you know, in my view, we need to have a engagement with China. We need to have a dialogue with China. They are the second largest economy in the world, likely to become the largest economy in the world in the next couple of decades. And we need to have a healthy relationship, but we also need, again, to do so without naivete. We need to know, you know, that what we're doing is actually helping to deal with some of the issues that we talked about earlier. So I'm hopeful that with the increased dialogue we've seen just in the last couple months, that we can get back on a more normal track here, but at the same time, again, have a conscious, strategic de-risking. And again, the private sector is doing a lot of that on its own. But some of it, government will have to play a role in terms of some of these truly strategic goods and technologies.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The breakdown of recently announced USDA Specialty Crop Block Grant Awards provided by Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, Jenny Moffitt.
We just announced $72.9 million.
Divided among 55 states and territories, with funding going to
specialty crop producers, organizations that support specialty crop producers, as well as other marketing organizations across their state. Projects can include things like investing in food safety, specialty crop research, developing new and improved seed variety, increasing child and adult nutrition knowledge, consumption, and education of specialty crops.
The 2023 edition of the awards are unique in that
this year marks an investment of $1 billion combined total since 2006 of these projects. So there are now 12,000 projects with $1 billion in investment for specialty crop block grants across the country.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.